Welcome to Renzo Republic.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the one and the only Remso Republic podcast. I'm your host, as always, Remso W. Martinez. Go ahead and do me a quick favor. Go ahead and follow me on Twitter at Remso101. That's R-E-M-S-O-101. Follow me. I'll follow you back. That way, we'll go ahead and expand our ever-loving fan base. Here at the show, we've only got one job, and we try and do it very well each and every time. It's definitely corny, most likely a ripoff, but we frankly don't care. We're trying to make freedom fun again. That's right. We're going to go ahead and talk about economic freedom, individual liberty. I do me, you do you. We don't use the government as a violent middleman to force or coerce anyone to live any particular way, and we can all live nice and fine and peaceful from there. Sounds like a simple concept, but it's radical for many. For those of you that are new listeners, thank you for coming on another great episode where we'll go ahead and, you know, hit the ground running as usual. For fans that have been hanging on for a while, I have a question. Why haven't you joined our Patreon program? For a dollar, just a dollar, you throw that away in pocket change, you can go ahead and support the show, get access to cool premium content, such as the sci-fi driven mystery pulp theater, the paranormal phenomenon that hit the internet by storm, Haunted Republic, the ultra creepy and fun, salacious Past the Headline. You can go ahead and listen to the last episode I did with my Uncle Brody of the former boy band C-Note as we discussed the Harvey Creepystein scandal and so much more. And so much awesome stuff you can get along with it, such as a signed book at the beginning of each and every season. If you go ahead and subscribe at $10 or more a month, our last book giveaway was a signed copy of The Politically Incorrect Guide to American History by the one and only Dr. Tom Woods of The Tom Woods Show and the Mises Institute. Everyone that signs up that level higher got a free signed copy of that book as we celebrate coming back for another season. Anyway, we're trying to change things up from last season. We're trying to go with kind of a theme, if you will. It's this idea of who are the disruptors. And by disruptors, I mean the people that are not just staying a given course, they're going and they're diverging from the given path of how we do things. They're trying to innovate. They're trying to create. They're trying to think outside the box, if you will. And when it comes to that, people tend to think that millennials are not necessarily disruptors, but they're just moving in a different direction. Some people think that's bad. When I think of all the great things that have happened over the past 17, 18 years, it's hard to say that millennials haven't been part of that. It seems that the boomers and the Gen Xers think that we don't contribute. But, you know, the next time you call an Uber, log on Facebook, or think about how you're going to go ahead and get your iPhone to work, or call your grandson to figure out how to turn on the Xbox, you can go ahead and thank your millennial brethren. But when it comes to so many other really important things, though, such as why we think net neutrality and the GOP tax bill is going to kill millions of people in a Terminator 2-style Judgment Day scenario, we tend to pull out the Bernie bros and the rest of the dumbass part of society that we try really not to think about. Love them all, great human beings, but come on, we really need to actually consider whether or not we think Venezuela is a good social plan for future development here in the great United States. With me to talk about that today is the president and founder of the Millennial Advocacy Council, Elliot Harding. Elliot, thanks for joining the show.
Thanks for having me, Remso. I appreciate it.
Not a problem. So, Elliot, why does everyone hate us? I know I sent you a couple other questions, but I feel that with that rant, that was probably the best justified question. What have we done to deserve so much hate?
I mean, I would say that listen, man, we're the largest generation in the United States right now. Last year, we took over as the largest voting age block in the United States. And it just so happened that that was the same cycle where only one party affirmatively went after millennials. In fact, only one candidate, and that was Bernie Sanders. And so what you've seen is the worst of us, that being the most socialist version of us, because that's what came onto the national stage. But people forget most millennials were, at least on the right, they were very attracted to Ron Paul back in 2012. And you know, we've been split among party lines. A lot of people I know my age voted for Obama and then didn't know what to do in 2016. But I think we get a bad rap because the spotlight has been put through a prism of socialism and the left, and yet the right has not affirmatively looked for the millennials to be a part of their group. And so that's why we get a bad rap. It's because they're only elevating the far left version of our generation.
Something that right-leaning movements and organizations, especially if you look at the Republican Party, for example, are often criticized with is this concept of, you know, the millennial problem. And I don't think it's fair to say that, you know, it's just the GOP that has a millennial problem. I know that that's a running shtick, a narrative that even many people on the right tend to fail with because they're like, oh, it's just nothing but me and a bunch of older white men. But that's really not the case. If you want to look at things at like the macro level, everyone, you know, the Democrats and the Republicans, they both have a millennial problem because 60% of 18 to 35 registered voters in the United States as of 2013 aren't even registered. I mean, even if they are registered that way, they are registered as independents. A majority of millennials of that 40%, probably 25 to 30-ish, are going to go ahead and say that, you know, they're left-leaning or they identify as registered Democrats. And then the minority of that 40% is saying, okay, I'm a self-identified Republican. So do you think that label of, oh, it's just the Republicans that have the millennial outreach problem is true? Or do you think the fact that, you know, the Democrats, because they're able to get that majority of voters out during general elections, that's all that matters? Even when it comes to every other election cycle, they don't, you know, the millennials don't care to show up.
Well, I think you raise two good points. And I'll start with the macro one. And that is, yeah, both parties have a problem in the aggregate because institutions as a whole are generally distrusted by millennials. And that applies not just to political institutions, it applies to corporations, it applies to institutions of higher education, it applies to things that have been static for a very long time and have not been responsive to innovation or the issue prioritization that millennials are seeking. So in the aggregate, both establishment institutions are having problems. Now, when it comes to which party is winning the vote, it's the left. The left is winning the vote. It's just that's what the numbers show. It's what they showed in 2017 in Virginia. It's what they're showing on obviously on college campuses, and that's a very big component of this whole conversation. But at the end of the day, the left is winning it because they beat the right to social media. They beat the right to trying to be hip, trying to be cool, what have you. They play to the emotions. They play to the sense of equality and fairness, which we all know is equality is not the same as liberty and freedom. Okay. We can force everyone to be equal. That's communism, but some are going to be more equal than others. Right. And they play on this emotional, doctrine. And they've also been able to benefit from socialized education for most of our lives. So the left is beating us to it, but in general, they both have problems. And that's why you're seeing disruptive forces. You're not seeing a lot of millennials moving towards the trajectory of establishment Republicans or establishment Democrats. They want to see disruption. And that's where we're at.
One thing that you brought up, which is so incredibly important, is that, you know, the left is eating our lunch when it came to not just messaging, because anything can be messaged anyway, and it could be a really good message. But it's communicating constantly. It's communicating in the way and the forms that young people communicate. That's the most important thing. And I guess some of the problem that, you know, I had as a young adult that was not a fan of the GOP very much was the fact that I felt that whenever Republicans were doing millennial outreach, it felt patronizing to a large degree.
Oh, it is. It absolutely is. In fact, what the most patronizing thing I've seen recently is some of the millennials that mainstream right media is trying to shove down our throats. It's like typecast. It's, oh, we'll take the same cheerleading talking points and put it in a bright young face and say, hey, look, we're hip, we're reaching out. And at the end of the day, you're not touching any of the issues. You're not changing your narrative. You're not changing your rhetoric. you're regurgitating the same talking points that have been losing you younger voters for the past decade. So it is patronizing and it's infuriating. And it's one of those things where, you know, you almost have to seize the day ourselves and say, look, this is what we really want. And quit waiting for them to give it to us.
Do you think the rage politics has kind of, you know, drowned out policy? Because the interesting thing about Bernie Sanders was that, and this is so weird because I didn't plan on bringing this up, but I will say this, his supporters, like I could probably go up to like a handful of Bernie Sanders supporters during the primary days, and they could probably give me like two or three issues that are like legitimate concerns. TPP was a big one. Banking reform, healthcare. And then I can go to five Hillary people and they're just going to call me a homophobe, Islamophobe,
sure,
colorophobe, whatever phobe of the moment. And it was so weird because here you have the exact opposite of what you'd think you need from millennial outreach. You have a crotchety old communist that thought the Sandinistas were on the right side of history, saying that everyone just needs to give more. But he got them to care, and he didn't do the typical Obama-style things you would do. He didn't go out on Ellen and all this other stuff. And then it's like, oh, the Republicans, they care too much about policy. You know, you're pushing out Paul Ryan and his five-point plan, and you're wondering why people aren't retweeting his stuff. Where do you think the disconnect is? And do you think that policy is something that, you know, people actually care about? Or do you think it's the constant 24/7 Tommy Lahren rage politics?
No. I think, listen, it's one thing if you're talking about baby boomers and Xers or whatever. But millennials actually care. All right. And it is funny. I had a conversation at a Hanover Tea Party grassroots conference earlier this year. And after I talked about millennials afterwards, this older fellow came up and he said, you know, the problem with millennials is they think they know everything. And I said, that might be true in some settings, but I don't think we know everything. I just know that we can know everything. Meaning we have the internet at our fingertips, right? We can learn things very quickly. Even if we don't know them, we can be skeptical. We're natural skeptics. And so with that, we care about policies, but it's which policies? You're talking about Paul Ryan's five-point plan. You just listed with Bernie Sanders three things that are pretty disruptive, right? The first one, I know the second one you mentioned banking reform. I know you mentioned healthcare. And at the end of the day, Ron Paul, when he was talking about ending the Fed and he was talking about, you know, data collection and he was talking about the war on drugs and criminal justice reform, or why are we getting intervention, you know, interventionalism and how that's costing us so much money and lives. These are disruptive policy concepts. These are things that are contrary to the norm of what we've seen since the mid-90s, if not before. And so it's what policies are we talking about? Are they the policies that are disruptive? Because those are naturally attractive but to millennials. But are they just the same talking points over and over again about – I mean, tax reform sounds great, but it's very hard to sell as a disruptive policy to millennials. I mean, most millennials, if they're lucky to – between their student debt and their FICA, if they have the jobs that they need and they're living on their own, then maybe tax reform puts some more money in their pocket. But they've never even lived to reap the rewards of their own work. So it's very hard to message certain things to younger folks.
That does make a lot of sense. And the interesting thing about what you and MacPac have done is, you know, you guys have spoken everywhere from outside on baseball fields doing rallies to, you know, going to the Hall of Power down there in, you know, the White House in Washington, D.C. And as during the 2016 general cycle, when you guys were traveling around the Commonwealth, getting to talk to different people, what were some of the biggest concerns you heard from those you met while going on tour with MacPac?
Well, it was a great time. The first kind of tour we did was it was like an 8 or 10 town city tour, college towns. We tried to bring in young Republicans off campus. We brought in the college Republicans that were on campus. And, you know, we were hearing some stuff that you're not hearing from the modern day narrative. Student debt is up there. It is a priority. And that's where, again, you were saying, why is the millennials are cast as such a negative light? It's because the left has controlled the narrative. The left beat the right to frame the issue of student debt. when people hear student debt, they think, oh, free college, Bernie Sanders, that's a socialist plan, right? You hear student debt, that's what you think. But that doesn't have to be the answer, right? It's just the right hasn't thought about it. The right hasn't put out their own plan. The right hasn't tried to frame the narrative in a conservative fashion to be able to address a problem. And so student debt was a big one. You're hearing things about criminal justice reform. Is that a priority issue among the GOP? I don't know. I mean, it is with some members. It isn't with others. A lot of people want their jobs. They want the government out of the economy. Things like Airbnb, Uber, Lyft, this gig economy, the sharing economy, freelance. At the end of the day, the corporate structure of working for the same company for the rest of your life, that's just not what we're going to deal with. The average millennial is looking to have 6 to 7 jobs in their life, whereas prior to that, it was maybe 2 to 3 two generations ago. So the economy and the benefit structure, the way that taxes are done, they need to be reformed to match the type of flexibility that people are expecting. And so that's where we're at. And then you hear the social issues. And at the end of the day, the most cliche thing I can hear from anybody, a 35 or younger, is I'm socially liberal, fiscally conservative. It might as well be the mantra. And what they really mean by that is I'm socially neutral. I don't really care what you're doing. I just want people to be treated equally, and I don't want hate, and I don't want bigotry. And as far as fiscally, I want you to quit spending so much money and taking it all away from me.
That brings up a really good point. It also touches on something that you mentioned earlier that I kind of want to spend a moment on. You were very correct when you said that when it comes to millennials, they're extremely skeptical, and you know they keep a wandering eye over on fixed institutions. You know, these monolithic organizations and entities that, you know, they just need to be questioned because they've led to so many disappointments and failures over the course of their young lifetime. And when it comes to this, you know, fiscally responsible, socially neutral stance, I'm not gonna say that this is a libertarian generation, because I actually do think that that's been, you know, bloated to an extent in terms of the definition that people have tried to apply to millennials. I'll just say that they are politically apathetic. If I say that, you know, majority of millennial voters are just politically apathetic, would you say that's accurate or inaccurate?
A majority, yeah, I'd say yeah. But I'd also say that, so yeah, okay, millennials, you take their current age bracket, let's say 18 to 35. Yeah, a majority of them are apathetic. But what I would also say is that I think more are active at this age than previous generations. Does that make sense?
That makes sense. And, you know, I want to emphasize that primarily because there's this misconception that once, you know, that when it comes to millennials, once they're on the left, you can't convince them to vote another way. And I used to believe that until Donald Trump came around. And next, you know, I'm seeing all these Bernie bros wearing MAGA hats, and it's incredibly strange. Do you think it's possible for the GOP to bring over left-leaning millennial voters? And do you think that would be a good thing if we were to do that?
Well, sure. I mean, no one is lost, right? I mean, you got to go and you got to convince. I'm going to paraphrase the Churchill quote we all know, where it's what? If you're at 18 and you're not a liberal, you don't have a heart. But if at 30 you're not a conservative, you don't have a brain. I mean, that's you know, almost 70 years old now, that quote, and you know, almost 80. But what I would say is that I don't know if the traditional word liberal conservative is meaning what we thought it meant anymore. So when you were saying the concept of us being libertarians overbloated, I feel you. I think long term, though, that's where we're going to go. So I think you're going to see a lot of these left leaning, whether it's the Bernie bros or the people that voted for Hillary because they wanted to see a female president, or they didn't like Donald Trump because of his rhetoric. He seemed mean. Whatever, I think over the time, they're going to grow into a more libertarian stance. It's not going to be the traditional conservative. It's not going to be the social conservative. It's not going to be a neoconservative. It's going to be, they're going to mature into a libertarian stance. So I think the roots are there. They're not all there yet. But I think the more they get into the workplace, they get familial development, they have to pay their taxes, they get more active in their local community, they have kids, I think you're going to start seeing more libertarians pop up long term.
So we've covered a lot. Actually, I'm looking at my notes. We we covered everything and more, and we've got 5 minutes left on the clock. Elliot, I kind of want to switch over to the upcoming Virginia Senate race, if that's cool.
Sure, absolutely.
Okay, so everything we've discussed, I think it rolls perfectly into this, because in a, you know, we're done with year one of the Trump administration. And, you know, everything has changed. The Overton window, I mean, someone just took a bat to it and they just beat it like a dead horse. And the great thing about this is I'm really excited for this upcoming race, because what you have is, you know, several candidates that each offer something distinct in their own right. And, you know, you have Corey Stewart that's riding off a very popular streak that he's been able to maintain since, you know, his 2016 run for governor. He represents more of that populist message. He's talking about things that most Republicans have not wanted to talk about, such as immigration. He's stood pretty firm on that. And for the most part, he's able to bring up a lot of people that live in the South Ends. You know, they're working class folks, and they're typically older, while he does have a pretty consistent millennial base of people that are continuing to follow him. You have E.W. Jackson, who's extremely, extremely stringent social conservative. He has a foreign policy view straight out of the Bush 43 days. And, you know, he represents more of the type of, you know, Huckabee Santorum brand of conservative that most people have tried to, you know, kill, bury, and then, you know, salt the earth above it. And then you have folks like our mutual friend, Delegate Nick Freitas. He represents very much of that Mike Lee, Rand Paul, you know, let's have the government so small it could fit in the Constitution. And then over on the left, you have everything bad in the world, the policies of the Clinton era that, you know, just were dredged up with Obama and just completely just vilified. And now it's in the incarnation of our current senator, Tim Kaine, who doesn't represent anything innovative, who doesn't represent anything that most millennials care about, and for the most part represents everything they despise. So what are some of the biggest challenges you see for anybody reaching out to millennials, both on the left and the right? And then we can kind of divulge from there.
The first thing is not to be off-putting, okay? And you were talking about the success of Trump earlier. I saw today Rasmussen poll has Trump's polling this time at the end of his first year. That's the exact same as Obama at the end of his first year. 46 approval, 53 disapprove. But the reason that Trump's moving up in the polls isn't because of his rhetoric. In fact, it's in spite of it. It's because of his accomplishments. So you're talking about people riding a populist wave. That's fine. That is what sells the car. It's flashy, and boy, it looks like it drives fast. But the reason that the polls are going up is because the engine under the hood, and that's what people really want. And so you can talk about how to get millennials from the right. The first thing that people need to focus on is the nomination. And again, millennials are the largest voting bloc. They trend independent. And so the thing you need to do first is don't be off-putting. If you are coming in with a hate-filled rhetoric against other individuals, other groups, look, we're the most racially diverse group. We're the most, you know, indebted generation. We have the highest education levels. That's for a lot of reasons, as far as graduate schools and things like that. At the end of the day, bigotry, hatred, divisiveness, it's just not going to work. And people can roll their eyes at it and say, oh my gosh, that's a bunch of snowflake talk. But just look, just don't go that way. Just pick a different narrative. Don't be divisive among your peer group. You need to add, not subtract. You need to multiply, not divide, in order to win. And so that's one thing I would say. But I would also say, let's start talking about the issues that millennials care about. You know, I listed a few earlier, but be willing to go there. Just because it's not a problem that you typically think about doesn't mean it's not a problem. I mentioned student debt earlier, but economic reform to meet a future economy, criminal justice reform. Why are we involved in so many wars that aren't even declared, right? More millennials have died in the war on terror than any other generation, yet they're still in Afghanistan 16 going on 17 years later, right? These are things that you got to talk about. You got to data, privacy. You know, we were joking about having the tape over the top of our laptop to keep them out. The NSA, things like the Patriot. Now, these are things that people don't want to talk about, but it's creepy and it's involved in all of our lives. And as a politician, you got to be willing to go there. And that's the number one way to get them. Now, once you have the nomination, oh my gosh, man, Tim Kaine has been awful on a lot of the issues that the left typically loves, right? I mean, he was the mayor of Richmond, the lieutenant governor, the governor, and a senator. Yet look at Richmond schools. How are they doing, right? People talk about not wanting the left always talks about political financing, campaign finance. Let's look at his campaign donation history and see the type of favors that have been doled out. I mean, at the end of the day, you got to call him out. And I don't mean hate-filled. You don't need to vilify. Just lay out the facts. And I think we can get there. I think with a small government message, it's more appealing. I mean, criminal justice reform, as a great example, is inherently small government, at least at the federal level. And these are places I think our party needs to be willing to go.
Which of the GOP candidates, because if we include everyone, including Kaine, it'll get a little bit more dicey. But, you know, because we've been so critical of the GOP, let's just kind of keep that microscope on there. Of the candidates currently running, and folks, I don't know if Gilmore's jumping in. So if by the time you listen to this, he's in, I'm sorry, but
I don't think he's going to, but include him if you want to.
I'm going to mess up because by the time this comes out, anything can happen. And then people are just going to be like, Remso, why'd you screw up? Remso, why'd you do that? And I'm just going to be like, no, retrospect, learn to love and forgive. Okay. So let's just focus on the three that actually matter, because if I really want to be nitpicky, I can go ahead and be mean and say, hey folks, remember in 2016 when the only people that voted for Jim Gilmore in his home precinct were Jim Gilmore and his wife? I'm not going to go there.
Don't have to include anyone who hasn't announced. So yeah. Let's involve those guys.
So Corey, EW, Nick,
sure.
Who do you think is going to have the biggest problem? Who do you think is going to have the easiest time
to get the nomination?
Let's just say millennial involvement.
Oh, the hardest. Okay.
If we're going to talk about the nomination, I'm going to have to bring out like a Ouija board or something in a crystal ball, because that's going to start getting complicated.
I don't know. Nick Freitas has the easiest time for sure. Okay. For a lot of reasons. He's actively gone to multiple college campuses. He is a young Republican by definition under the age of 40. That's the Federation. He's been a member of it. He's got a great wife, Tina Freitas. They've got great kids and they're very active. He's willing to talk about the policy issues that I was laying out earlier. You were talking about Rand Paul and Mike Lee. They're the ones that hit on a ton of issues for a long time that are attractive to millennials. And he's somebody who's going to work hard, and he's laying out he's not attacking the other candidates. He's not getting into a war of personality. It's more, let's break it down by issue. Let's break it down on ideology, and let's talk about what separates me from you. Now, the hardest one I think is going to be E.W. Jackson. I don't think the staunch social conservatism, which conservatism is an odd word to apply to this. I don't think the government is going to be the source of your, I don't know, life mandate. I don't think that you're going to be able to culturally reform people through the arms of the government. And that's something that the left has done. They've tried to do, and we hate it. I don't know why we think that we should combat it from the right. Okay. We need the government out of our lives, not pushing it in another direction. And so I've heard him. He's a great man, and he's served, and he's a great pastor. And I think that he probably has done a phenomenal job in his churches. And I think that he will do very well in the places that he is most familiar. He's run a statewide race before, but I think he'll have the hardest time. And in the middle there, you have Corey Stewart, who came off of people think it was a close loss to Ed Gillespie, but they forget that Frank Wagner got about 50,000 other votes that probably would have gone for Ed Gillespie. So had Frank Wagner not been there, it would have been a 55,000 vote win for Ed. So it's not as close as people really think. He's coming right off of another statewide race, though, so he kind of has some name ID. He's done his best to drum up these circus types of elements of showing up the Lee statue multiple times with people. I mean, he has multiple appearances with people that are on, like, the SPLC hate watch lists. He went down to Alabama to help out with Roy Moore in another loss. I mean, he loses a lot, but he gets a lot of attention in so doing.
He's
so,
like the Clay Aiken of the GOP.
There you go. Yeah, he's like Clay Aiken. And I don't think millennials are looking for Clay Aiken. I think we're looking for our Carrie Underwood or Kelly Clarkson or something.
Definitely. So, I didn't know it was going to get to that point, but that's perfect. The Clay Aiken, that's all I'm going to call him from now on. I'm not even going to refer to him as his real name.
Does that make EW Ruben Studdard? I don't know where this goes. They were in the same season, so.
Oh, man. It's getting dicey on that part. We'll have to touch bases on that one. Anyway, Elliot, thank you so much for coming on. Lots of great info. If people want to check out everything you're doing along with Mac Pack and more, how could they do so?
So we have a great Facebook following. It's Millennial Advocacy Council PAC, or Mac PAC. You can follow us. There's a blog that's not directly related, but a lot of good content Virginia-wise. That's millennialascent.com or .org, I forget. And then our Twitter following, we have a Mac PAC Twitter. I personally have one. It's EMH434. That's our area code up here in the Charlottesville area. And feel free to reach out if people want to get involved. We're kind of a statewide group of YRs and CRs and folks. We're trying to get people involved in their units, their committees, the party, and do our best to advocate on behalf of a rising generation.
Outstanding. Elliot Harding, thank you so much for coming on the program. It's been a blast.
Thanks, Remzo.
Folks, not going to keep you too long. Go ahead. And if you like this episode, if you even hate it and you want to go ahead and, you know, say a few things, go on our Facebook page, go to Remso W. Martinez, or go ahead and send me a mean tweet on Twitter at Remso101. That's R-E-M-S-O-101. As always, if you love us, two very easy things you could do. Leave us a 5-star rating and review on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Google Play. You know how the internet works. Helps us get on those trending charts for news and politics. And for all the additional fun after the show, go ahead and check us out on Patreon for as little as $1. That's just $1. That's 4 quarters. You're going to go ahead and spend it on something you hate. Might as well spend it on something that never ends and the fun keeps on coming down. As always, be good to your neighbor. Go out and treat yourself. And tune in next week, America. I'm Remso W. Martinez. Good night.
Stay up to date with the latest news and updates by visiting
RemsoRepublic.com.
Hey, this is Lloyd Bailey, the Armed Lutheran, host of the Armed Lutheran Radio Podcast, reminding you that the podcast you're listening to is a proud member of the Self-Defense Radio Network. Check out all the great content at selfdefenseradio.net.